is the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. That was a strange sound effect. And my guest today is the amazing Tadek Celik. Tadek, hi, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jeffrey. How's it going?
Good, good. I've been, I was working on doing a little write-up about you prior to the show, and I was looking at your Wikipedia page, which is out of date, but still pretty fascinating, and your bio at Nevada Part, and man, you've had such an incredible impact on the web as we know it, starting at least as well, really starting in the mid 90s, but the standards based web owes you a hell of a lot starting in 2000. Let's talk about what you do today. For starters, you're a director at Mozilla, is that correct?
Not quite. I'm Mozilla's web standards lead.
Okay. They don't have directors.
They do. I'm not a director.
Oh, okay. What does a web standards lead do exactly?
So Mozilla brought me on almost 2 years ago, back in May of 2010, to basically help out with writing and editing some CSS specifications, some of which I've worked on in the past. And it turned out that there was a lot more standards work that Mozilla needed done. So this past fall, in October, I came on board as an employee at Mozilla. And what I've been doing, basically since they brought me on, even as a contractor, is trying to organize and figure out what are all the different standards bodies that Mozilla participates in, and who from Mozilla participates in them. So that at least amongst the folks at Mozilla, we can figure out, oh, we've got an issue with standard X. Let's go talk to, you know, Frank over there in that office. And that, you know, believe it or not, that kind of thing with an organization as big and distributed as Mozilla was, a challenge. Especially from my perspective, coming on board, it's like, okay, I'm the new guy, so let's assume I don't know anything, and I'm just going to go ahead and like help document things. And that's that turned into the leadership role of helping to coordinate things. It also means that when a standards request comes in, when a web standard request comes in, like, you know, what is Mozilla doing with this web standard or whatever, it often ends up on my desk. And at that point, it's part of my job is to figure out, well, who's handling the standard, and if not someone, find someone, or perhaps handle it myself if it's in one of my areas of strength.
Which are many. But first of all, so it sounds like you're doing... You started by just, you know, doing kind of a UX person's job of who are the players, what are their different goals, and what are the organization's goals for web standards, how is it achieving them, are there gaps, who does what, and figuring out workflow issues. Okay, so you figure out the workflow issues, and you have, I would guess, markup and CSS are two big areas of strength for you. Is there some web standard... I'm not aware. Is JavaScript compliance part of web standards, and is that something that you might hand off to someone else, or how does this all work?
It is. JavaScript compliance is absolutely part of web standards. It's part of what we all depend on to help make the web work and do various things. In that area, our CTO, Brendan Eich, handles essentially everything with help from a bunch of our engineers as well. And so that's we've got that. He's also happens to be the inventor of JavaScript, so that's a good thing.
That's a plus.
Yeah, that helps.
What about back-end standards? What about core, like really baseline core standards like HTTP and all that? Because as some people listening know, compliance with those things isn't necessarily a given.
Yeah, there's standards, as you're pointing out, sort of all across the stack, from very visual things like CSS, and images. Even things like PNG are standards we have to make sure work properly, all the way to HTML, JavaScript, and then on the HTTP to talk to the servers. And there are even more back-end standards like that under development, some of which are being led by Mozilla. So one example is Browser ID, which is Mozilla's attempt to provide user-driven identity on the web, and that's been a challenge for a number of years. a number of folks have worked on, and this is currently one of the latest approaches to solving that.
Explain what that means.
So browser ID, or what user, which means, sorry.
Browser ID. Browser ID as user identity. This doesn't mean Jeffrey Zeldman.
Problem in general.
Okay, sorry, there was an audio dropout. What does browser ID mean?
So browser ID is a handful of protocols and APIs that allow a user to essentially say, okay, I want to identify myself using a particular email address when I log into a site. Okay, and the idea is that the user wants to use that particular email address without having to create a password for every single site that they want to say, I've signed in with my browser ID provider, and that browser ID provider now vouches for me as being, for example, jeffrey@zeldman.com on other sites. And that has the advantage for the user of not having to remember different passwords for different sites, not have to worry about sites if they get compromised, like Gawker, having their password leaked, and then other accounts being leaked out there. It also, for the site itself, relieves them of the responsibility of having to deal with users' passwords, because that means that you're a target, and you potentially get attacked, and
right.
Then you're who knows what other harm could come of that. So we're trying to do the right thing there for both users and sites at the same time. And we think that there's a good solution there.
Now, there have been other schemes for letting the user enter one password once. I mean, there's an app called 1Password that's that the user uses, which is very there's 0auth, which is an anonymous way of, or you can log in with your Twitter account, your Facebook account. There's lots of stuff out there. Why is this better? Or how is this different? I mean, you're handling the responsibility to the browser rather than an organization. How does that work?
That's a great question. So,
Tantik, are you there? You just dropped out. There's still no audio.
Still no audio?
Oh, there you are.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. Perhaps it's perhaps I need to upgrade my DSL or something. Well, there's been several attempts at doing this kind of what we call delegated identity, where you're having something besides the site that's wanting your identity log you in. And OpenID is probably one of the oldest that actually succeeded. And that worked well for a while among a certain set of folks, but there's always been challenges with the user interface for logging in using some other identity. And I'd say some of the more recent attempts using, say, Twitter to sign into accounts, or for example, both PlanCast and Lanyard let you sign in, authenticate with via Twitter. Or Facebook, for example, there's Facebook Connect, and numerous websites allow you to sign in or connect with your Facebook login as well.
Right. So isn't that good enough? Why does Mozilla want to do something different?
Well, the question is, what happens when you lose your account at one of those organizations? Then everything that you've signed into with that account is essentially inaccessible. So do you really want to trust that that Facebook will not cancel your account for whatever reason, or Twitter for that matter? Do you want that dependency or not? And there's been enough cases, for example, documented with various accounts like that. There's also Gmail, where people lose their account, and all of a sudden all the different sites that they logged into with that account are no longer accessible.
Does that mean they can never get into those sites again, or does it just mean they have to re-log in individually using a different... Can they connect their new password to their old password, or have they Like it, in other words, if I authenticated everything via Facebook, and I had a whole bunch of photos stored, let's say in a given web app,
right?
Will I lose access to my photos on that app because I also lose access to Facebook?
Very possibly.
Okay.
That's going to depend on the specific service. Some services potentially allow you to create a separate username and password just to recover your account or to change it. But in general, you know, everyone is trying to ship their apps so quickly that it's one of the fastest things. It's like, okay, I'll just put Facebook Connect on there.
Sure.
And then people can just log in, and then we'll worry about, you know, the other stuff later, right? And so that's sometimes later doesn't come, and then you've got the service that's dependent on that. So the idea with Browser ID, and it's taking this to some extent from OpenID, is that no one company should own your identity, or rather you, the user, should get to choose where to place your identity and control that and move that around at will. So that's this is sort of based on the principle of user choice, which is one of the principles that drives Mozilla.
Okay.
Okay.
So stop for a second.
Yep.
So you're a big proponent of own your data. For instance,
yes.
You, Tondik Celik, when you tweet, you don't initiate your tweet at Twitter. You initiate it at Tondik.com and then echo it at Twitter. So you're a big believer that, you know, Twitter might go away. We both had the experience of Magnolia going away.
Yeah.
I recently had the experience of Gowalla going away. So all that data that you accumulate in someone else's backyard, that person can always sell their house and move, and vultures can come into the backyard, right? So I get why I get your advocacy of, although I get your advocacy of own your data. Is something like Browser ID an admission that owning your data is probably something for very technical people like yourself, but some other solution is needed for an average web user? In other words, this is sort of a compromise between owning their ID and just signing their life over to Facebook.
I see it more as a first step rather than a compromise.
Okay.
Because owning your data needs to start with owning your identity. And what I've done, and what you've done, others have done, is we've bought our own domains, right? I've got Tontic.com, you've got Zeldman.com, plenty of other folks have their own domain, and we've chosen to host our blogs or other content there. But that's not something that everyone does,
right,
or necessarily can do. But
I think you and I both naively or optimistically thought everyone would when we started.
I think we're still hoping for some of that.
Yeah,
at least that's definitely one of the aims of the whole indie web camp,
right?
Effort that I've been working on,
which I want to hear about,
to create a community around the idea of owning your identity and data, and really living that life.
Which is interesting because you're up against
challenge.
The thing is that so it's indie versus pop in a way. I mean, you're a small group of very smart geeks, Matrix-like geeks, up against Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, and just not to cast Facebook or Twitter as villains, but just the way our culture works when somebody's valued at $1 billion and they've got a CEO who can come up and, you know, fill 10,000 seats in a room, it's hard to present an alternative idea to that. It's hard to fight for an alternative idea to that. Our culture worships big.
It does. And $1 billion, I mean, you're just talking about the Instagram part of Facebook now, right?
Yeah, I think what was Facebook? Right. Right. Exactly. You think it's funny?
It's a huge challenge, and I think that's one of the things that's hampered, I believe, the whole sort of independent web or own your data movement in the past has been, to be frank, there's been a lot of talk on email lists and not as much action. And frankly,
that's always true.
This is one of the changes that we've put in motion with Indie Web Camp. There is no Indie Web Camp mailing list. If you want to participate in Indie Web Camp, you must be a creator. You must be someone that owns their identity already, and then contributes, whether it's design, mock-ups, user experience, code, style sheets, doesn't matter. You contribute something to the commons, right? That you publish something and share it with others as open source and open design for others to reuse. And that's really made a big difference with actually helping to move things forward. We've also
Who else is involved besides yourself?
So we've got a pretty broad, a diverse set of individuals. We've got there's folks in Portland, Oregon. There's folks all the way across the pond.
Is that what you were doing in Portland a couple of weeks back when I was there?
A couple of weeks back, there was a bar camp in Portland going on, actually. And we were doing some planning for the Indie Web Camp that's coming up in June and July.
You're one of the creator. You're the creator of Bar Camp, are you not?
It was certainly my idea in the first place to do Bar Camp, and I kicked it off with a few co-founders. Six of us. It's still kind of amazing that six of us put this together in 6 days. It was kind of insane.
You worked at Apple back in the old days.
Right? Yes,
and I
very
think,
old before Steve's return days.
Right. Okay. And you worked at Microsoft at a key time in web standards. You led the development of IE5 Mac, the most compliant browser of its time, and the Tasman rendering engine. And you were on the CSS working groups at that time. And the web standards projects, you were very pivotal in those early web standards days. I'm also wondering if somehow, and I don't mean to pry, but if you, when you left Apple and when you left Microsoft, they gave you something like besides a pat on the head, because you do seem to, I know you weren't born wealthy, and yet you do seem to be able to throw yourself into a tremendous number of volunteer activities that most of us wouldn't have the time to do unless, you know, we had some reserves in the bank. So I'm just wondering how you finance the indie lifestyle that you lead. The sort of if there were deadheads of, but not deadheads because very smart heads. But if there was something like, you know, people who follow the Grateful Dead, you seem to follow. You know, you seem to like go around proselytizing with microformats and all this other stuff, and I'm just wondering, is it maybe part of your job description at Mozilla? Does that help you cover those expenses? How does that work exactly?
To a certain extent, that's part of the reason why I'm at Mozilla, was that we found a really strong overlap in terms of the standards-related projects I wanted to work on, and the open web, and the open independent own your data web, as well as, you know, all the different things that Mozilla works on. So that's worked out really well.
So it's almost like you're a consultant to the web itself, having all these brilliant ideas about independence and authentication and web standards and microformats, formats for the formats for people first, machines second, and Mozilla is kind of like the de Medicis or something. They're the sponsor who says that lines up with our values. So we will pay you a salary to keep doing what you're doing as that lines up with our values.
And I'm far from the only one at Mozilla like that. In fact, I would say Mozilla is dominated by individuals that believe in all the things that you just said. And it's been kind of amazing to find so many sort of unspoken colleagues that work tirelessly on all kinds of different standards and security and user choice and all these things. And I'm still meeting amazing people there that I'm just fortunate to get to know and work with. So it's an amazing place to work.
There's a culture of that at Google as well. I'm wondering if Google folks and Mozilla folks get along, or if there's a certain friction, or if you guys get along and basically see yourselves as saving the world from, say, Apple.
Well, it's interesting. There's definitely a lot that Mozilla and Google get along on. If you look at a lot of the web standards groups that Mozilla participates in, Google participates in many of them as well. Things like the CSS Working Group or the HTML Working Group or the Web Apps Working Group. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in the CSS Working Group, and there, Google's participants, like, for example, Tab Atkins, does amazing work. And that's been great to be able to work with him in the open there as well.
Do you work on, I mean,
sorry?
I'm sorry. does he work on Chrome and you work on the Mozilla browser, or is it more you guys both work on open standards and specifications and somebody else thinks about the browsers?
Well, I think it's somewhere between those two, where we both work on standards and we work with the developers that, that write code in Chrome, or sorry, like Mozilla and Chrome, respectively, right? Or WebKit in the Chrome perspective, in the Chrome instance.
There was go ahead.
So Google does have dedicated standards people like Tab Atkins, and that's always really great to see when companies hire individuals and say, "Hey, we want you to work completely on the open in this." And that's probably one of the other reasons that I have stuck with Mozilla so long, is that one of my conditions for when I started was I want to do all my work in the open. And they actually let me do that and encourage that. Mozilla has an open wiki, wiki.mozilla.org, and I keep my project list, everything I work on an open wiki page. In fact, anyone can log in and create an account and even add stuff to it. Now, people typically don't, but it's part of that degree of transparency that has attracted me and kept me at Mozilla. And if we're going to draw one contrast, I would say I haven't found any other companies, you know, whether it's Google or Apple, anybody, where A, there's an open wiki that they keep for the company, for employees to talk about their work, and that B, that employees are allowed or even empowered to or encouraged to keep their project lists in the open, where anyone can review them and provide suggestions.
Because that's what the web has always been about.
Yes. I think that's the web has fundamentally altered our culture, and this openness is a big part of that. I do think that there's still what we could refer to sort of like legacy corporate culture that encourages people to do things behind closed doors and sort of tries to lock down, you know, patent protections on things with the assumption that that's how you build value at a company. And that's a battle that we're still fighting, I believe.
How do you feel about Apple?
Wow, we could spend a whole hour on that one. They make great tools. And I have ended up using all Macs for my development and all my day-to-day usage. I have an iPod Touch. I don't have an iPhone because I don't want to sign a contract with a phone company. I've been disappointed too many times.
There's something about you that you could be mistaken for one of those off-the-grid guys who's totally, you know, who lives in an armed camp in Iowa and is preparing for an Armageddon. You're not that one of those guys.
No, I'm living in San Francisco, so no, pretty urban living
okay,
there.
Okay, but the whole avoidance of contracts and that sort of thing.
Oh, well, it's one of those things where, you know, if you have experience, if you've been let down with a contract with an individual, you're unlikely to go back to doing contracts with that individual. The same is true with organizations. And I've certainly had my fair share of problems with cell phone providers and support that I've decided, you know what, I'd want to just be able to change my provider month to month, decide who's providing better service. And frankly, I think that's better for users in general, is that when users have the ability to change what browser they're using or what phone they're using, that's when you get better browsers and better phones.
Sure. But
when users are locked in, then innovation stagnates.
That's why companies love lock-in. So yeah. We were talking about Apple.
We were talking about Apple.
You worked there for 5 years?
For on and off for about 5.5 years. Part of that was an internship, and then about 4 years full-time.
That was right out of computer science school.
Yeah, even overlapped a bit with college while
Stanford,
I was
right?
there.
You went to Stanford?
I couldn't wait to get started. Yes, I went to Stanford and I got a summer internship with Apple and talked them into starting part-time with me.
How did, I mean, that would seem a more, where you are now, and I could say the same to myself, but where you are is so far from where you started. Where you started, it's like you're I know you love The Matrix, but it's like you're Neo, but you started as, you know, a programmer at a respectable software company. You know what I'm saying? There's sort of a wild man part of you, or a very independent mindset, which doesn't usually go with a programming job, or does it? How did you get to be you?
How did I get to be me? I think that the origins of that kind of independent mindedness really started back in junior high school, and first getting a chance to start using Apple II computers to program, and really getting caught up with the whole, like, this is an Apple computer, so you're an independent and you get to program and write code, and it's meant for the rest of us. It's not a business machine. And that whole 1980s era kind of Apple versus IBM, where Apple was the rebel, really kind of, you know, fit into my way of thinking there. And what happened to me eventually, though, was that I discovered the web, and I discovered, more important than that, open web standards at Microsoft, of all places, and found that really aligned with my interests.
What are some of the things that you have achieved inside the W3C that you're proud of?
I'm pretty proud of CSS 2.1. That took many, many years, and is probably, I think it's one of the most solid documents to ever come out of W3C as far as technical specifications. There are other things like CSS3 color and the selector specifications, both of which have made it to W3C recommendations, that I'm fairly proud of. But perhaps sort of most recently what I'm proud of is the W3C's effort to adapt and become more nimble, which I've contributed a bunch of feedback and input towards, and has resulted in their establishment of what they call community groups. And I think that's been a huge step forward, because it took us many years to make that happen. We had to create our own efforts like microformats.org and whatwg.org in order to pursue these like independent standards efforts, because it was too hard or too expensive or too corporate-centric to get something started at W3C. But W3C now has made a big change with community groups. And that's, I'm pretty proud of that, to see that.
I agree, and I think that's really important. But I wonder, do you see innovation mainly coming from W3C now, or do you see it mainly coming from what working group, Mozilla, Google, Apple, and sort of filtering back to the W3C?
I've seen it come from, let's say I see it come from three different places. One, I've seen innovation really in the last several years come from individual companies. So I think that, for example, what Apple did with pursuing WebKit, you know, animations and transitions and transforms, and launching all of that, was amazing, was incredible innovation. I do think it's taken us a bit too long to standardize that, but that's a whole separate discussion.
There's a whole
list of part article I can forward your listeners to.
We'll
talk about that.
Yeah, which one is that?
That's Eric Meyer did an interview of me, and I forget the exact title of it. It was about vendor prefixes.
Right, because you were the one responsible for the controversial decision for Mozilla to support WebKit vendor prefixes.
Well, to at least start that conversation openly. And that's one of the things.
How is that going, by the way?
Different with Mozilla, right? We get to start a conversation openly and say, well, we haven't made a decision yet, but here's what we're thinking about. And then people think, oh, wait, have you guys decided? No, we're talking about it in the open. And that seems to surprise people, when it's not just like, hey, there's a corporation that makes a decision and here you go in a press release.
Sure. By the way, it's the vendor prefix prick predicament, ALA's Eric Meyer interviews Tantek Celik. And if you just Google Eric Meyer interview Tantek, you'll find it immediately.
Awesome. Then I'll have to work with Eric on perhaps a future interview to hopefully follow that up. So the second place I've seen innovation come from is some working groups at W3C have actually produced. I know it sounds strange, but I have actually seen some good innovation by committee. It's rare, but it does happen.
Okay, give us an example.
And the CSS working group is one of the places where that's really happened. Border images are a good example. That's an area that I and others have worked in the CSS working group for years to try and figure out how can we do border images that make sense, and kind of like tirelessly iterated there, not behind closed doors, but shall we say, in an area of the web that most people typically don't watch. And as a result, now we've got this amazing like border image property that people can use to make incredibly beautiful stylized borders.
What does it do besides rounding the border? Which is what I use it for.
Oh, so you can do all kinds of. I'm sure you've seen sort of
frames, the dots, and the
museums, and you can do all kinds of like you can basically put images in each of the corners of the border, and you can tile images along the sides of the borders as well. So if you have some crazy curly Q thing you want to put as a big border, big flourishes, you can design as a designer what you want the corners to look like, and then you can also design images that get tiled across the sides that connect the edges and make your borders beautiful. And that's like far more complicated than anything we could do with just a border style.
Right, and more complicated than anything we could do even with sliding doors.
Yes. And certainly with less markup and hacks.
Right,
and such.
Exactly. Right. Go ahead.
So that's a good example, I think, of innovation that's come out of the working group. And then the last place that I see innovations coming from, and perhaps this is the biggest area, it's kind of like my favorite, is from the independent innovator on the open web. So you get folks that get together and say, hey, there's a bunch of stuff we want to make happen on the web, but none of us are potentially active in W3C, and we're just going to propose something.
So Paul Irish. As an example.
Well, Paul Irish has done great work with the framework, which I'm just now forgetting the name of.
Right.
I'm
not going to help you. I mean, I would help you if I could, but I don't. He's done
along with a modernizer, right? Yeah. So him and of course Farooq Katesh,
right?
And there's been great work coming out of that, similar things like jQuery. But those aren't necessarily standards.
Right.
When we talk about sort of standards innovation, I'm talking about things like microformats.org or like WebWG or OAuth or even OEmbed. These are all things that emerged out of a small group of people deciding, hey, we want to innovate some stuff on the web, and we don't see these other existing standards organizations doing them.
Or the proposals, Matto is one of the people behind this, the proposals for responsive images.
Yes.
Right? That to make them, like, it's great that we can use jQuery and server calls and do all kinds of voodoo to not give a person on a small device too big an image and to allow someone on a big device with lots of bandwidth to get a big image, but there should just be a simpler way of doing that. We should be able to do with the image element what we already do with the video element, which is provide a whole bunch of fallbacks based on different contingencies. But it's that kind of thing where someone recommends something. And that was also in a List Apart article that Matto wrote.
Yeah, the
limits of responsive images.
Responsive images. We need to solve that. That's an area that you're right, is another great example of that third source of innovations, perhaps even primary, that we're seeing of independent web developers and designers.
Right. Matt Martini.
Posting about stuff, blogging about stuff, then finding others that share their passion for solving that problem and then collaborating. And that's been great to see.
I called him Matto, I meant Wilto. Jesus, this is just, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I couldn't remember Modernizer for a few seconds, and I'm sure.
Yeah, but I work with him. I work with him, and I call him by the wrong nickname. Hopefully he doesn't. No, nobody really listens to the show that works with me. Hopefully so.
Well, this all gets edited in post, right?
Not really. No, this is it.
Okay.
It's just going out over the Ethernet, just like this. Matt Marquis, responsive images, how they almost work and what we need. Is the link. I'll put all these links on Zeldman.com, so it'll be easy after when the interview goes up.
Great. Great.
That bell.
See, Apple has been a really interesting story to follow. I mean, just sort of following up on your previous question.
Sure.
Just for me personally, the Apple used to always represent the rebel, the computer for the rest of us, and that kind of thing, as well as ease of use, right? Because, you know, for a long time, Linux was also sort of like the rebel, right? But that's never been ease of use and usability has never been sort of a cornerstone there.
No, hardness of use was sort of the bragging point there.
Yeah,
you had to be a geek,
like a proving ground kind of thing. Like you got your merit badge.
Programming. It's macho programming. We've all gone through phases of, I do this because it is hard. I don't want a tool that'll make it easy.
And that's, you know, I think that's actually okay. That, like, hey, this is the mountain is there, so I'm gonna go climb it. I think that that's okay, and that's there are folks that need to go do that, and that's respectable. But you mentioned, you know, and maybe that does have some bravado associated with it. That, like, I'm gonna do this because I can, and I'm gonna prove to the world that kind of thing. But you mentioned the whole programmer reference, and I feel like I can't necessarily let that slide without really calling out that's more of a, that there's a little bit of a different problem going on there,
mm-hmm.
and it involves kind of a frat boy sexist culture, which I don't necessarily see as something we need in our industry.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we get rid of it. Tweeted about something that I actually saw Jason Fried tweeting about first, which was the striptease thing. It was like,
really?
It was just so, I mean, it wasn't, okay, so it's not photographs, right? So it's kind of, you could say, oh, it's just a joke, it's just cartoony. It's a little pixelated cartoon character, woman stripping, and I didn't download it and try it. For all I know, if you're a woman, they have a male version. I don't know. But it just seemed so dumb and sexist, and, you know, it's just what happens when you put, like, 12 guys in a room with Doritos and Mountain Dew, and none of them go out on dates. This is what happens.
Yeah, it's kind of sad, because it's not, you know, I don't think anyone wants to, no one that I know consciously wants to discourage women from the industry.
Right.
But there are these effects, these sort of cumulative effects that pile up, and then people don't realize that they're being jerks. Right, and then the defense is often, but it was just an attempt at humor. That's
It's called Naked Password, by the way, nakedpassword.com.
Oh, brother!
And I said an idea whose time has come prematurely.
Oh no!
I did.
Oh boy!
Well, what are you going to do?
Yeah, there's, you know, I think that there's a tendency to. There's also some overlap with alcohol abuse. I think that goes on when you talk about the whole programmer culture.
Really?
Yeah. Which it's like, you know, go ahead and we'll do these hackathons and we'll have, you know, fresh cold beers served to you by our women staff. I mean, I'm not making
really?
That up.
That really happens.
That was an actual advertisement for a hackathon that a company put out, and then later. They are incredibly criticized for it, and then actually ended up canceling the event. But there's a great Mother Jones interview. Is it an interview? No, article. It was actually just published today about this called, and I'm just reading the title here, which has got quotes itself. Quote, gangbang interviews, quote, and quote, bikini shots, quote, : Silicon Valley's programmer problem. And that's the title. We can share the URL after the show.
Well, it's an article.
It's an article on MotherJones.com.
We'll share it after the show. Okay.
Yeah,
but we'll share it with the listeners. We're not going to do it secretly.
Right. That summarizes.
That's what I thought you were saying. I don't know why. I thought you were saying, I'll share that with you after the show. It's pretty hot. Which kind of contradicted everything you'd said up to then, so I'm not sure how I got that interpretation, but anyway.
I think that they did a pretty decent coverage of the issue. But what I wanted to contrast is there's a culture of, like, shall we say, climbing the mountain or even like planting the flag. Like, I'm going to go solve this really hard problem. I think that's a positive culture. And I think that when people do that, we should, you know, raise them up and be like, hey, you've done a great job. This is awesome that you've shared this. You know, you've accomplished this. You've shared this, you know, openly with the web, and others can benefit from that.
Yes.
I see that as a positive.
Yeah, so of course.
In as much as people apply that to Linux or whatever hard problem you're solving, that's great. And I want to see more people do more of that.
Well, and frankly, good design, making stuff so it's simple so that a child understands it, so that anyone can use it, that's a lot of work. That's a very hard problem to solve.
That's a very hard problem.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I want to see, and frankly, I want to see the same kind of design mountains solved and done so openly. Like, hey, I've solved this really difficult design problem, and by the way, here is my work. I'm going to share it openly in the same sort of culture as open source. And I think that's an area that our industry could benefit from. Let's just say there's a lot of bad design out there, and if more good design was shared openly with encouraging folks to copy and mimic, then perhaps
I don't know if I agree.
Better good design out there, more good design.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I think you can design a nice template that you give away with a blogging platform or something. But I don't. Design is very specific. Design solves specific problems, and I'm not sure how you can give that away or encourage copying. Without just encouraging inept, bad design.
We would say the same thing used to be said about code, that coding always solved very specific problems. You know, application.
Okay, so you can say we could agree that, like, let's say that we could agree that marking up lists as lists was a good idea, and everyone kind of settled on that and agreed, or we can agree that marking up headlines in size order is a good idea, and I guess, you know, people people will release icon sets that are nice that other people can use, that, you know,
perfect
for things that need to get done on a lot of websites, like,
that's right,
we all, you know, well, how do I make I need a Facebook icon, and I need a comment, or a, you know, I need a default avatar if someone doesn't have Gravatar installed or whatever. Those things you can definitely give away, and lots of people do. And there are even typefaces of you know, limited use typefaces that are given away. So there's all that out there. But I don't know. I think design is a hard problem, and you know, it's like saying we should just give away sets of words. There's a lot of bad writing out there, so let's give away sets of words.
But people do. There's Creative Commons developed. There's Creative Commons written essays and documentation. You know, that, for example, that's, you know, we talk about web standards. Microformats.org. We decided all the stuff that we contribute and publish is CC0 licensed. And that's a lot of words, and that's a lot of work. And the idea is that, well, if we make the standards publicly reusable, like public domain, CC0 reusable, then more people will adopt them, more documentation and books and other materials can be written about them, and the standards will succeed, and the entire community benefits.
There are limits to it, though. I mean, you do,
right.
People do copy sets of words, and that's why you have every fifth tweet is like, sad robot is sad.
Right.
Happy dog is happy. Ugly pizza is ugly. You know, because people do copy. I mean,
I'm eating a cheese sandwich.
We do learn from each other by copying. Well, that's different. I want credit for that. I want credit for that cheese sandwich.
And I think that that's important that, you know, we do that, right? Credit is, I think that's a big part of why Creative Commons has the whole CC BY.
Right, attribution.
Got to do the attribution thing, and I think
somebody
that's
needs to rewrite Creative Commons licenses so they're even more user-friendly and less lawyer-friendly, because still, when I look at them, I'm confused. I now know how some of them work, just because I now know, but not because I read it and found it easy to understand them. I mean, admittedly, there are things that are harder to understand, but still a little too... And it's a hard problem, because they are lawyers, and it has to be legally enforceable, so that might be why. There's something about the law that encourages vague, confusing language, or encourages, like, dementedly specific language.
Yeah.
Says the man who's just finishing a divorce.
Oh. Well, the laws, I think we have some of the similar problems in standards, although we've tried to make them easier to read and understand. And I think we can do an even better job, though.
Well, the part about standards where they're specs for browser makers, they kind of have to be super specific. Because when you don't have that, that's when you get, you know, the original IE box model implementation, which was actually a much better box model, but wasn't right.
Yeah. I agree that standards need to be super specific for browser implementers. However, I kind of disagree with the framing of that statement, maybe unintended, that they should be primarily for browser vendors. And that's an effort that I'm helping out at W3C, actually, right now in the CSS working group. We have an effort to redesign from a content level what our specs, how our specs are written.
That's beautiful.
Who they are written for.
What is that activity? Is there a URL for that activity?
There is a URL for that activity, and it's actually on the W3C's wiki, which is a good thing, because it means that we can hopefully find it fairly easily. I believe the short term for the effort is called respec. Like R-E-S-P-E-C.
Tell me what it means to. Maybe.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's not a coincidence. It's
right.
Part of this is, I think we need to...
There is no page more. Title respec. Is there a hyphen in there somewhere?
I'm looking up the spec prod.
Respec.w3c. Respec.js. W3C specification writing tool.
Oh, that's not it. Okay, I found it. Restyle. It's got a longer name. Specprod/restyle. Restyle W3C towards a more usable spec template. Yeah, I guess it's at w3.org/wiki/restyle.
That will be up. That link will be up as well.
And I'm working on that with a few other folks in the CSS working group. And as with many things, we're trying it first in the CSS working group. But if we do a good job, there's a good chance that W3C as a whole will adopt this as another way of doing standards, and then hopefully other working groups can do that as well. And this is one of those things where it's great to talk about this stuff in theory, but you need to see it in practice,
right?
To really see if it works or not. I've been championing for more readable specifications for years, because I learned how to write specifications at W3C. And it's been made clear to me over and over again from web developers and designers that W3C specs are kind of like hitting a brick wall. Like you get there and you're like, what is this?
I mean, it's good because it provides work for Eric Meyer and Dan Cederholm and Ethan Marcotte and me and you and lots of other writers to go like, well, here's what it means.
Sure, but there's no absence of work for you guys.
Right, there's no absence of work, right. There's actually...
Even if you made it more readable, you guys would still have ways of doing more awesome things with the specs. I don't see any problems there.
Right. People used to say, "Well, I don't want there to be web standards because I get so much money for knowing the 18 ways to code a website." And
right.
I'd be like, "Yeah, and you could make that same money and have photography, and have and have a copy editor,
and you could maybe publish many more books, right?"
Right.
And that's. So the one place where I'm experimenting with that, which I want to encourage your listeners to take a look at, is the is the HCard specification on microformats.org.
Okay.
Where I'm the editor. So if you, literally it should be the first result if you Google for HCard.
HCard microformats wiki.
Yep, that's it. And this is, as any wiki page and any spec, it's a work in progress, but a good portion of this spec has been rewritten in the way that I think makes it more, in ways that I think make it more accessible to more people.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautifully
so you start,
readable.
You know, it's like there isn't like a big long preamble. You've got a short summary of what the heck is this thing. You got an example, and then you've got a summary of the features. And then you've got more details down below. But to start with, part of my goal here is to make it so that the typical web designer, developer, author, even journalist can find this page because maybe they heard about microformats, maybe they heard about HCard. They can get in, find what they want, and get out. They don't need to waste a lot of time. And like I said, I'm not saying it's perfect by any means, but I think that I've made some good forward steps here, thanks to a lot of feedback over the years. And
it's human friendly. It's very human friendly.
Yeah, we're working on it. There's lots more work to be done here. This spec could be made much friendlier still. But I'm hoping that the beginning parts of it have improved to the point where more people can find it useful more quickly.
Tantek, we've been speaking for, I believe, over an hour, and I'd love to keep going because I love talking to you. Thank God there are people like you in this world who give us so much, who contribute so much to making the web friendly, usable, smart, and do this, you know, motivated purely by a desire to improve the new publishing medium, improve the new communication medium, improve the internet for all. So I want to thank you very much for being my guest.
Thanks, Jeffrey. It's been an honor.
It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor knowing you, and we'll talk again soon. And listeners, we'll be back with another Big Web Show soon. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.